Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost. And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia.
Yes, we did. We multiplied and we needed more. We are back for another sterling hour here of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman. We are going to be doing our usual intro on nuclear power, especially the San Onofre nuclear plant, which is on the brink, we hope, of shutting down forever. We are working really hard. I've got two great people from California back with us to talk about the week's developments. There are plenty of other developments to talk about, too. If you're playing at home and want a scorecard to look at, go to www.nukefree.org. www.nukefree.org. That's what I'm going to go right now and call up all the latest nuke news that I post every day to keep us abreast of what's happening in the world of nuclear power. Once we talk about nukes for a while with Ace Hoffman and Milo Reason, we are going to jump in with David Swanson, one of the great peace activists of our generation, going to talk about Syria, what's going on over there, drones, Guantanamo, all the stuff that a collapsing empire is made of. So let's jump right in now. Myla, Ace, you with us here?
Hello. Hi, this is Ace.
Ace, how are you? Okay, hopefully you'll have Myla with us in a minute, too. Ace, we've had a... This is Ace Hoffman we're talking with, our resident expert from Southern California on San Onofre, the nuclear plant there. And Ace, why don't you give us a quick rundown on what's going on. I'm going to call right back because I hear an echo. So just tell us all the week's latest developments on San Onofre.
Well, we're still pushing the events that were going on last week and the week before. Things just keep progressing in the same way. So the most important thing that we need people to do right now is to go to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and tell them you don't want them approving the restart of this plant because the tubes are busted and the plant is dangerous. One thing after another keeps coming out as to what is wrong with San Onofre. The latest description of it is incubating circumferential cracks that are being ignored by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Southern California Edison, Mitsubishi, Areva, Intertek, Westinghouse, all the guys that did the very close look at the tube wear that's occurring inside the steam generators were completely ignoring other kinds of damage, fatigue. This is what the incubating circumferential cracks are.
Oh, I love those. I love terms like that. Incubating
circumferential cracks.
Okay, so tell us what that is.
That's just one more of the tiny little technical details that Southern California Edison ignores in their attempt to restart. They look at the 10,000 tubes in each of those steam generators, and they say, well, how much have they rubbed against each other, and how thin is that wall, and is it going to get so thin that we can't continue to run it? But they completely ignore the fact that the tubes have been bending back and forth, and you might not see that kind of wear as rubbing wear. And suddenly the thing cracks, and the whole circle breaks off. That's incubating circumferential cracks.
Oh, my God. And how serious is this?
Oh, well, this is terrible because the steam generators are one of the primary boundaries to keep the radiation away from the public. And so if these things are not capable of handling a significant event like an earthquake or a tsunami or just a valve opening or closing somewhere in the line or a station blackout because there's wildfires, any number of these things can cause the plant to have higher pressures than necessary. None of the equipment is working. The reactors shut down. You know, plunk go the rods. The reactor coolant pumps trip. The feed water pumps trip. The turbine trips. And then all of a sudden you've got this enormous pressure on these tubes and they break. They're incubating circumferential cracks, expand all the way around, and they fall apart. And now you're dumping primary coolant to the atmosphere. This is not legal.
So you're saying that the tubing in the steam generators, which is basically the radiator on your car, except on a nuclear plant, are developing cracks that could cause them just to fall apart?
Yeah, exactly. Imagine bending something back and forth over and over again a million times or many millions of times. And eventually they're going to break. If you can't always calculate how soon they're going to break, but it's a normal engineering fact that if you stress something, so if you put more force than it's designed to take, then the chance of these circumferential, these kinds of cracks propagating, these fatigue cracks, goes way, way up. So the contention comes down, in the case of San Onofre, to, well, did these tubes experience this greater force than Southern California Edison calculates they exhibited? And then you have to go to the experts, and they say, well, the experts are saying, yeah, absolutely. The force could be more than twice as much, four times as much.
So essentially now, people have to envision this. So we're talking about, with Ace Hoffman here, about the San Onofre nuclear power plant. Myra Reason, are you with us?
I'm back. Yeah.
Okay. Myra?
I'm listening attentively.
Okay, great. So the reality is you're talking about tubes that go back and forth, back and forth. There's, what are those, like 19,000 tubes in a steam generator?
Yeah, more than that. No.
More than that. And so, but they're just basically, what, about an inch in diameter or so, maybe less?
Yeah, 3/4 of an inch, maybe an inch.
And they carry hot water back and forth, turn it to, then they hit regular water and turn it to steam. But what you're saying is, and the hot water that goes through these tubes comes directly from the nuke and is intensely radioactive and ridiculously hot.
Yeah.
And so you're saying that these tubes could just flat out fall apart. Sorry to laugh about this, but it's so ridiculous. This is a nuclear power plant we're talking about. These tubes could just flat out fall apart and dump all that incredibly hot radioactive water into the secondary coolant water and just have an apocalypse.
And worst case scenario is the meltdown.
Yeah, and then drain the reactor core of coolant. Oh, God. This thing's right in between Los Angeles and San Diego. It is right smack on the ocean, for God's sakes. And we're talking about Mickey Mouse car radiator nonsense here. I mean, I have an old Volvo, and my radiator went. My daughter was driving this thing last year. The radiator went. She didn't know any better. She drove, 1 minute and melted my engine, costing me $3,000. This is all of Southern California we're talking about here, and a lot more too. Or am I exaggerating?
Well, it's a million times worse in terms of the money. According to the San Diego Union Tribune, they just quoted a $3 billion figure for the problems at San Onofre, which I guess is a million times worse than your daughter's $3,000 problem.
Yeah,
but Ace, were they factoring in the value of all of the properties and agricultural land and people's personal homes that would be contaminated so that they could not return to them? I mean, what's the value there? Then we're talking trillions, I think.
Well, gazillions. I mean, it's incalculable. I mean, right. you're talking about a massive accident at San Onofre, which is ringed by earthquake faults, directly much more vulnerable to tsunamis than Fukushima. Much lower down, nowhere near as well protected as Fukushima was. And Fukushima, of course, was hit by an earthquake more than 100 miles away. The epicenter of the Fukushima quake was over 100 miles away, even if it's a big one, 9.0. But the San Onofre, as well as Diablo Canyon up near San Luis Obispo, these reactors are ringed by earthquake faults within 5 miles, 3 miles,
It's on top of one, but yes, there's earthquake faults all around. And there was a quake back on December 14th of last year, the morning before the Los Angeles City Council heard its first resolution on San Onofre. And that was, Ace, do you remember? It was about 100 miles offshore, 50 miles, 50, I think.
Yeah, something like
directly,
that.
Directly west of the power plant. If it had been a larger quake, that could have been the big tsunami that inundated the plant.
Even a smaller quake can knock some rock formations, underwater rock formations, off their cliff edge, wherever they happen to be, causing a tsunami that could inundate the plants.
Yeah, I mean, that plant, Diablo Canyon's a little higher and a little further back from the ocean, but San Onofre, I mean, this thing could literally tip over and lay down on the beach, for God's sakes. It's utterly insane. It's like, sometimes you just have to laugh at how crazy this thing is. So we've seen, I've got posted at nukefree.org, a burgeoning procession of articles about this. Energy Biz, which is no enemy of nuclear power, it's a trade organization, trade magazine, has carried the story, which others have carried, that the CEO now of Edison, the primary operator of San Onofre, has said that they are at least considering shutting both down and not reopening them, and that the decision would be made in 2013. We also had a major piece in what is the UT in San Diego, whatever that stands for?
Union Tribune.
Oh, the Union Tribune in San Diego. Dan McSwain wrote a pretty snarky piece, putting down Edison and talking about, what you mentioned, Myra, the $3 billion price tag right off the top. It seems to me that this monster is moving a little closer to shutdown. What's the latest feel from Southern California?
Well, from my point of view, it's that they're going to snooker us and suddenly start it up rather than shut it down. That's what my big fear is, that we're not 8 months away from permanent shutdown, as Craver hints. We're 6 weeks away from restarting it, and who knows what happens after that at 70% power, whatever that means at the tube junction.
I think what we have to keep in mind is that if they are not allowed to restart soon, then it's going to be very difficult for them to be able to convince the California Public Utilities Commission that they can continue to charge the ratepayers for energy that they're not supplying. And some of those costs may be shifted to the shareholders rather than the ratepayers. And so that's pretty much what's driving the big push for restart. I mean, I'm sure that the California Public Utilities Commission would like nothing better than to go along with Edison, because after all, the president of the California Utilities Commission, Michael Peavy, is a former Edison president. The Public Utilities Commission, it makes it harder for them to get along with going along with Edison if Edison is not able to supply some power via their broken, dangerous nuclear power plant.
Well, we now have some indication.
That's what's really driving it. The ability to continue to gouge the ratepayers and not have the shareholders pay for Edison's mistake.
Right. Now, yeah. For those of you listening in from other parts of the country besides Southern California, the reality is that San Onofre, if there was a single nuclear plant in the world that was perfectly designed to irradiate the entire United States, it's San Onofre. It's right smack in the wind pattern there. God forbid a major catastrophe at San Onofre would send a radioactive cloud across the entire United States within 4 days. And, it'd wipe out the Central Valley, where much of our winter vegetables come from back here in the cold, dark east, and do just incalculable damage to everything along the way. It would wipe out San Diego and Los Angeles, two minor financial assets, as well as the home of my grandson.
The port of Los Angeles, don't forget about that.
Yep. And
$1 billion a day in business there.
We're talking about a high-powered rifle pointed right at the head of the United States of America here. So this back and forth about the detail in Southern California about San Onofre is very relevant to anybody listening who resides in the United States of America. Now, there is a serious chance that we can keep it shut. It's been shut since last January, a year ago. And they're only talking now about reopening Unit 2. One of the big questions is, they went through last summer, Southern California did, without major brownouts or blackouts while San Onofre was down. I'm assuming that there's been a substantial leap forward in alternative sources of energy for Southern California.
My leg, right?
No, I mean my son and son-in-law and daughter and have installed solar panels on their home in Valley Village at no cost.
On a personal basis, there are thousands of people who are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of how much needed to be done to ensure that there wouldn't be problems over the summer, they've barely touched that iceberg.
Well, we know that for good reason. They don't want alternative energy to displace their precious San Onofre asset there. But we assume that Southern California will be in better shape this summer than they were last summer to cope with the lack of the nuclear power plant.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what case can they really make except to a completely corrupted utilities commission? It seems to me...
Can I just say something on that point, Harvey? Because, you know, we had a town hall meeting with... Henry Waxman, the ranking member on the Energy and Commerce Committee, this past Thursday evening at a town hall, I asked him about San Onofre, and one of the things that he said was that when the plant went down, he instructed the independent system operator for California to make sure that we would have sufficient energy for Southern California for this coming summer. Or I don't know if it was exactly at the beginning of 2012, but at some point he wrote a letter, and his committee members signed on to a letter instructing the independent system operator to make sure that there would be no difficulty and that we would get through the summer just fine without San Onofre. And I believe that that's what, that there's no reason to think that we need that power. It's unnecessary power. Now, interestingly, there was an article that was just published a couple of days ago in the Union Tribune, San Diego Union Tribune, where they hinted that maybe the independent system operator would issue a report this week saying that they might have some trouble this summer. But I think, Ace, actually, your response to that was pretty brilliant. Do you want to take it from here?
Well, just that there are so many ifs, ands, and maybes in that statement that who knows what they're going to come out and say. I think I said it's like saying you might go to the beach. If you go to the beach, you might drown.
Well,
yeah, it's possible.
That's always a possibility, I suppose.
They're going to have blackouts anyway from all sorts of things. If it's possible that one or two days they have a blackout because they didn't prepare, well, then let's play the name game, the blame game, and blame Southern California Edison for not installing demand response systems so that people didn't burn their air conditioners unnecessarily, at peak periods.
Now, David Swanson, you're on with us here, David.
Hey, Harvey, how are you?
Good. We're joined by David Swanson, the great peace activist, one of the great peace activists of our generation. And David, you're in Virginia. You had earthquakes. We're talking about San Onofre here in the California seismic zone, but I'm in Ohio, and Ohio claims the only nuclear plant in the United States, well, the first nuclear plant, let's put it that way, in the United States, to be damaged by an earthquake. It was the Perry nuclear plant on January 31st, 1986. And David, your state, Virginia, claims rightfully the plant was operating when it was hit by an earthquake. You want to tell us a bit about that, what happened in North Anna?
Oh, we're very proud. Yeah, this was, last summer, two summers ago, that there was an earthquake that many strongly suspect is tied to fracking that occurred to the west of us. So there's a big push to move ahead with fracking and bring that closer to the plant. This is the sort of wisdom operating in Virginia, where there's also a big bipartisan push to start mining uranium in Virginia. That's going to be extremely helpful to everybody downriver from that. And there were, of course, lies and cover-up of what happened at Lake Anna, where there are nuclear power plants, and things cracked and things were damaged, and lies were told until an employee talked to somebody who talked to somebody, and the story came out, and they shut it down for a while until they claimed everything was fixed and hunky-dory and started it back up. But we're living near this potential catastrophe. And there's almost no regular coverage, much less reasonable concern about the danger.
Right. And, David, you're in Charlottesville, home of Thomas Jefferson and Dave Matthews. quite a pair there. Of course, that earthquake went ahead and actually damaged the Washington Monument, which is still shut down.
And the National Cathedral, reopened until quite recently.
So, Ace and Milo, do you have any fracking going on near San Onofre that might speed up this earthquake process here?
Not near, but they are pushing it in California.
Yes.
We've got fracking in Culver City, so that's about 60 miles north.
The same San Diego Union Tribune paper that promotes nuclear power most of the time says that it ran a cartoon that implied that fracking would reduce the price of gas from $4 and something a gallon down to $1 and something a gallon.
Yeah, what kind of gas?
That what's going to be fractured is the price of gas.
Well, I got to say, if you look at the green section of nukefree.org, you will see that there are huge breakthroughs happening almost every day now in the solar industry. It's astonishing how quickly this technology is exploding. I mean, it's, you know, Moore's Law about doubling computing capability every, what, year and a half, 2 years, yeah, is certainly coming to bear with renewable energy. And, you know, you're fighting a good fight out there on San Onofre. I'll have you back, if you will, next week. We want to continue. I view this, you know, having done this, this is my 40th year fighting nuclear. I think if we can keep San Onofre shut, it's going to take a huge hit to the nuclear industry, because Southern California is really, we now have feed-in fracking in feed-in tariffs in Los Angeles, and renewables are really going to boom there. And this is the first time this week that we're talking, Ace and Myla, that we've had some kind of public rise, I think, from the head of the of Edison, saying that they're seriously considering shutting it down. You can say it's partly blackmail, I suppose, but you know, these reactors have been down for 14 months now. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
All right, Myla Reason and Ace Hoffman, thank you so much for the weekly update on San Onofre. Be glad to have you back next week if you're available. I'm more optimistic this week than I have been quite a while on keeping San Onofre shut. We do have confirmation that it won't open until mid-June now, at least, from the NRC. I don't think they'll be able to sneak it in quicker than that. But we shall see. So we'll talk with you about it next week. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right, thanks, Darby.
All right, David Swanson. You are with us from the heartland of Tom Jefferson's Virginia, and we are going to talk, of course, about what's really relevant in Virginia, which is Syria. What's your take on this set of explosions now? Did the Israelis do it, and what are the implications?
Well, I haven't heard any real skepticism that Israel has attacked Syria and done so more than once, and done so at the expense of U.S. taxpayers, who, of course, fund the Israeli military to the tune of $4 billion a year. The debate that I've been hearing is focused more around the question of who used chemical weapons, if anyone, in Syria. And, of course, the claim came out last week. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, but there's a ringing on the phone for some reason.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's not on my end.
All right, why don't you go ahead and talk, and I will call. God, who knows where these... Oh, they must have hung up from California.
Hang up on the other guests. But
there you go.
The claim came out of the Obama administration last week that... yeah.
Okay, I'm going to call right back in. Go ahead and talk, and I'll be right with you, Steve.
So the claim from the White House was that the
was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
Solartopia.
Now we're going to have a Solartopia. Solartopia.
Hey, we are back at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're talking with David Swanson. And David, where are you there? Okay, we also have an author with us. Hello?
Hi, it's David.
Yes, David, it's Harvey.
Hi.
I don't know what's going on with the phone systems today.
Yeah, I could. Should we maybe try this another time?
Are we on? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, Harvey.
I don't know if we're just talking to each other or if we're on the radio.
Yeah, good question.
You're live.
Okay, we're live. Great. Here we are. All right, David. Proceed. What difference does it make if the Syrian government or if the rebels used sarin gas in Syria? Who cares?
Well, the U.S. corporate media and quite a few senators and quite a few weapons makers and a number of human rights organizations that bow down to U.S. Military interventionism care deeply because supposedly President Obama made a threat, and the threat is more important than the lives of any mere humans roaming this planet, and that threat was to attack Syria if the government of Syria used huge amounts of chemical weapons. Now, what's a huge amount? I don't know. But should the government of Syria use chemical weapons, or should the U.S. corporate media simply proclaim that it has, which has now occurred, then the world will collapse if the president does not maintain the follow-through on his threats that is necessary to keep the other 95% of humanity in cowering fear of the Pentagon. Now, of course, the information has come out within 24 hours from staff in Syria of the United Nations that it appears that, in fact, it has been the other side, the so-called rebels in Syria, that have been using chemical weapons. And now the United Nations has been under intense pressure to back off and say, actually, we aren't quite 100% sure of that ourselves. So you have these dueling assertions of, you know, various levels of confidence slash hope that we know what we're talking about or are making things up effectively enough to persuade the New York Times. And of course, the use of chemical weapons is illegal. It's illegal when the United States does it, when its allies sanction it, when it's been done in Iraq. But the United States uses all kinds of weapons that the rest of the world condemns, from cluster bombs to landmines to white phosphorus to napalm. And I don't think the people of Syria are going to be that much better off if they get killed with horrendous weapons approved by the United States rather than horrendous weapons approved by the government of Syria. I mean, if you die from a Hellfire missile, you still die. And people are going to die in much greater numbers if the United States attacks Syria or continues to sanction Israeli attacks on Syria. This is, you know, this is getting out of control, and of course it's being done on the basis of lies, half-lies, and exaggerations that are just pushed forward with such eagerness by the same media institutions that sold us the war on Iraq 10, 11 years ago. The Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has a great rundown today of, you know, which media outlets were smart enough to express a little skepticism and which simply declared as fact, going beyond the White House's own claims, that Syria had used chemical weapons and therefore we need a war.
Well, who's backing who over there and why? What difference does it make if the Syrian government wins or the rebels win?
Well, the rebels are a mixed bag of Al-Qaeda and various terrorist and fundamentalist religious groups that in various other times and places and nearby countries the United States declares to be the mortal enemy deserving of drone strikes. And the rebel side in Syria has gained support of dictatorships in the Gulf, of the United States, of NATO. NATO, whereas the Syrian government has strong support from Russia and from Iran, and so you have incredibly complex divisions within Syria and within the region, where the growing divide between Sunni and Shia plays into this mix, and you have the potential for global conflagration. You have missiles reportedly supplied by the United States shot this past week at a Russian passenger jet by the freedom fighters, the U.S. approved side in Syria. You know, anything could blow out of control beyond the imaginings of those in Washington who continue decade after decade in the face of all existing evidence to imagine that they can start a war and control it. It just can't be done.
David, you're a great historian. We know historically that virtually every war begins by people saying, well, it's going to last a week or two weeks. The Civil War in America, the people said that. The World War One, everybody thought it would last, it'll be just a couple months and here and there. World War Two, I don't think anybody had many illusions, but certainly Vietnam, we thought it would be a cakewalk. Dick Cheney told us that our troops would march into Iraq and people would throw flowers at their feet. I think he kind of mistook IEDs for rose petals. So now we have another situation here that's completely whacked out of control. And how dangerous is this, David Swanson? What do you envision? What's the worst case scenario here?
Well, the worst case scenario is global nuclear war.
Well, I mean, aside from that, come on.
Well, I mean, it's a seriously possible scenario.
Right.
I mean, the open stated intention of U.S. senators and people in power in Washington is to overthrow the government of Syria in order to take a step toward overthrowing the government of Iran. This is openly their plan, and you have these pretenses of humanitarian interest and concern for the lives of Syrians that is just nowhere evident in terms of the lives of the people of Bahrain or any other nation where the U.S. could much more feasibly be of nonviolent assistance. And so you have the potential for widening war, and war is very, very difficult to control. You have the chairman of the Progressive Caucus, Congressman Keith Ellison, a caucus that used to at least have chairmen or chairwomen who took an anti-war position, even if they would never whip their colleagues for it, openly pointing to Libya as a model and suggesting that we need a safe zone, which is his euphemism for a no-fly zone. And you look at Libya and you think, well, wars can be ended quickly. But Libya is a disaster with violence spilling into the rest of the region and even spilling back into Libya from Mali. You look at Iraq, where they decided to keep it going longer and were finally forced to end it, and Iraq is arguably in worse shape now, post-intervention, than Syria is pre-intervention. So, we don't need an intervention. We don't need a no-fly zone, which means a bombing zone. We need a no-weaponizing zone. We need Russia to stop arming one side. We need the United States and its allies to stop arming the other side. We need people to sit down and talk with the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians in the room.
Well, that's awfully sane, David. It's hard to imagine how we're going to move ahead with this. Tell us, David, a bit about your new position with the Green...
I'm sorry, my new position?
Yeah, in the Green Shadow Cabinet.
Yeah, I'm hearing lots of, wind or tornado sounds. If you can hear me okay.
Do you know where they're coming from?
Hello? Are you asking me?
David, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I have had the honor to be named the Secretary of Peace in this shadow cabinet, along with dozens of wonderful individuals who have been named to various positions, including yourself, if I'm not mistaken, Harvey.
Yes, I am the Green Shadow Cabinet Secretary of Energy.
Imagine having...
That.
Imagine having Harvey Wasserman as Secretary of Energy in this country. I looked at a report today from National Pentagon Radio on the need to expand Arlington National Cemetery in order to fit in more corpses and the environmental concerns over damage to a stream and to the trees and so forth. But if we actually had a concern over the killing of more humans and the production of more corpses, we might be brought to face the fact that our aggressive, destructive, militarist, fossil fuel economy is raising far more serious environmental concerns than just one stream and bunch of trees in Arlington. I mean, we need a radically different approach, a sane majority opinion approach, but a radically different approach from what's happening in Washington. And so we have a cabinet now that can model that sort of behavior and statements of opinion and shadow the existing cabinet that includes people like Ann Wright as Secretary of State and Leah Bolger as Secretary of Defense, and I'm happy to be working with them as the Secretary of Peace, although I don't have a real counterpart to shadow, because of course we've not created a Secretary of Peace.
Well, of course, Kucinich, who was gotten rid of here in the state of Ohio by a joint cabal of Democrats and Republicans that gerrymandered him out, but Dennis Kucinich has long been arguing for a Department of Peace in the United States government. So at least we have you in the Green Party government to advocate for it. And I love this Department of, I mean this Green Shadow Cabinet. I like to call it the Green People's Cabinet, but it's Jill Stein is really to be complimented for working so hard and continuing with her candidacy as the Green Shadow Cabinet President of the United States. And and David, so what are you doing actually as Secretary of Peace to promote peace?
Well, I'm doing more or less the same
besides
things I've always been.
Radio show.
I'm sorry.
In addition to being on this radio show, which is of course extremely important work, how do you see your portfolio here?
I think that's, you know, primarily it is being on great radio shows, but beyond that, I've just gotten back from a meeting of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, and I've written about that. It's at davidswanson.org or warisacrime.org, and these are people with inspiring stories to tell about how you can actually get away with not paying for wars and actually redirect your money to good, worthy causes. I just, you know, prior to that trip, I just got off the plane from Syracuse, where I was speaking with a crowd of wonderful activists that are going time and time again to protest the drone murders that are taking place halfway around the globe, but piloted, in some cases, not all, from that airbase there at Hancock Air Base in Syracuse, New York. And these are people risking over and over again serious jail time and beginning to educate the public in upstate New York and the judge who keeps having them visit his courtroom. And I flew to Syracuse from Dallas, where of course we had a big crowd there to greet the opening of the Bush Library.
We're the greatest collection of comic books in the Bush Library, and coloring books. Comic books and coloring books. We're greatly indebted to George W. Bush for that.
Yeah, I mean, this was the wonderful thing about building an activist movement with Bush in the White House was you had this personification, you had this caricature of both stupidity and evil, and Bush, the Bush-Cheney administration, right, the presidency of stupidity and evil, and of course those caricatures with a great deal of truth behind them matched up with our public policy. Now, of course, we have the same horrendous structural problems in Washington. We have the same militarism, the same racism, the same prison industrial complex, the same so-called wars on drugs, the same extreme materialism, to put in the other of the three triplets Dr. King named, and yet we don't have a face for them, and we have this imagination that the new president is with us and again and secretly against everything he's doing, and he's weak and he's caving in and he's falling down, and you know, so and it's you know, a million times harder to create activism, and so I've come to really appreciate the value of having a public personification that matches up with the evil of an organization or an institution. I mean, it's just invaluable. We had a crowd of people there to greet all these, you know, millionaires and others coming out of this event with the five former felons, the five current and former presidents there in Dallas. And this woman comes up to me and starts screaming at me, "Why don't you protest Obama? Why don't you care about Obama?" You know, and I said, "Ma'am, can you read?" Because I was wearing an Arrest Bush and Obama shirt. And so then she tries the different approach and says, "Well, if Obama's doing it, well, why don't you like it?" You know, and of course, you know, this is how people think, and she's fundamentally right. The peace movement has been gone for 5 years, but people think you're with one team or the other. They don't understand that you can be against murder. And that's the single biggest weakness of all the weaknesses in our activist movement at the moment.
Well, David, you're working hard to build this movement. What is your website, real quick?
Warisacrime.org and davidswanson.org, and I work for an activist group now at rootsaction.org.
Oh, cool. All right. So tell us a bit about your take on Guantanamo. Obama made some sort of a show of wanting to shut Guantanamo, but I've read stuff from you that expresses skepticism. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, he's made that show off and on since before he was elected the first time, that he, you know, quote unquote, wants to close Guantanamo. And there are many of his supporters around the country who believe he's already done it. There are many more who believe he intends to do it and wishes he could do it and wants to do it but can't because of Congress. And of course, his plan was not to eliminate lawless imprisonment. His plan was to move some of those prisoners whom he never intended ever to give a trial to a prison in Illinois rather than keeping them in the prison in Cuba. And that, of course, is not what we ultimately need. This is a president who, you know, decreed in executive order and then worked with Congress to legislate, in fact, the power to lock people up, including American citizens, which is what American citizens seem to care about, in prison forever and ever without charge or trial. So that's now become law, you know, albeit unconstitutional law. It's not a secret scandalous thing the way it was with Bush and Cheney. And he, in fact, has the power to close Guantanamo, to free those prisoners who have been cleared for release, and to give trials to those who have not, and to free the innocent and incarcerate the guilty and move on. Instead, you know, he's refusing to do that, and he's working with the usual sort of outsourced torturing in black sites that are officially owned by other governments in Somalia and other nations around the world, while at the same time having primarily moved on from incarceration and torture to murder as an easier alternative, so that people who under Bush would almost certainly have been arrested and incarcerated and possibly tortured are now murdered along with anyone who's too close to the missile strike that takes them out. And we're supposed to see this as an improvement.
Well, it certainly, it's a brutal picture that you're painting, and you know, our civil liberties picture in the United States just gets worse and worse. We just celebrated another member of the Green Shadow Cabinet, Tim DeChristopher, just got out of jail, but his imprisonment was utterly insane. This guy went into an open public land auction, bid off the cuff on public lands, told he couldn't do that for some reason. The auction was canceled. That all sorts of things happened, and he wound up in prison, really having broken no law that I can imagine. Did you follow that case, David?
Yes, indeed. I mean, a lot of people did. A lot of people are inspired by the stand he took and the outrageousness of the punishment. And you know, it varies from court to court and police force to police force. But we are seeing a gradual move toward a crackdown on free speech, on demonstrations, on activism, on opposition of all sorts, including journalism, to the interests of those in power.
Talk about that a bit. Tell us a bit about the breakdowns in journalism that you've seen. And most recently, because I am struck as I continue to read, the email and the wire every day, about how, repressive, our government is becoming, to me it's a sign of desperation, but nonetheless, this, mockery of civil liberties in this country has really escalated under Obama, as far as I can tell.
There's no question. I mean, a journalist who reported on the murder of civilians in Yemen with the first missile strike into that country by Obama, locked up with no end in sight by the government of Yemen at the instruction of President Obama. Journalists in our country, terrified to do their jobs, whistleblowers persecuted quite possibly beyond any previous precedent in this country. Bradley Manning facing court-martial beginning June 3rd, charged with aiding the enemy, charged with treason, essentially, for having done his legal and moral duty to expose wrongdoing within the government. The only recent incarceration for torture was of a CIA agent, John Kiriakou, who revealed that the CIA was engaged in torture, and in fact largely approved of it when he did so, but moved more and more into the realm of a whistleblower indignant at the crimes. We have prosecutions under the Espionage Act for whistleblowing that outpace all previous presidencies combined.
Let's talk about that. It's a specific situation with hard numbers. Tell us about these prosecutions under the Espionage Act. We're talking with David Swanson here. His website is warsacrime.org, davidswanson.org. He is the Green Party Shadow Cabinet Secretary of Peace, lifelong peace activist based in Charlottesville, Virginia. Tell us about these Espionage Act prosecutions, David, what the root is and what they're aimed at.
Well, this is a law from back in the World War I era, intended to prevent treasonous talk, intended to prevent aiding the enemy or counter-recruitment when someone like Eugene Debs spoke against recruitment into the U.S. military. That needed to be cracked down on. You now have whistleblowers, six or seven cases now under the Obama presidency of whistleblowers exposing embarrassing actions and criminal actions by the U.S. government, being prosecuted not just for the technicality of revealing information that was rightly or wrongly, almost certainly wrongly, kept secret from the U.S. public, but for supposedly aiding an enemy in war with the United States. And, you know, someone like Thomas Drake, who was at the NSA, who exposed unconstitutional spying, not to mention, you know, bungling and fraud and waste and incompetence at the NSA, was
prosecuted. That's the National Security Agency.
The NSA,
yes, the National Security Agency, the people who are now listening to this phone call, tapping into our emails, spying on us without warrant, in violation of the Fourth Amendment, routinely and openly, without the stigma that existed when Bush was president. These people, you know, were outraged. Obama was outraged. He sought to make an example, and he went after Thomas Drake, seeking to put him in prison for decades, if not life, for supposedly aiding an enemy. And the case fell apart, as it should have. But this continues to be the practice, and whistleblowing is collapsing, because those who blow the whistle face this kind of persecution.
Talk a bit about Bradley Manning. You said his trial is coming up in June. Can you tell us a bit more about his case and where it stands?
Well, Bradley Manning is, of course, the biggest whistleblower probably of all time, who has revealed massive amounts of information from the State Department, the internal State Department cables, as well as, you know, videos of war crimes in Iraq and so forth, primarily through WikiLeaks and then through other media outlets, including the New York Times and other newspapers. There will be a huge rally at Fort Meade, Maryland on June the 1st, which everyone should be at, and then his case begins on June 3rd, and it's possible to go and be in the courtroom and listen and watch. And in fact, there have been a lot of preliminary hearings, at the most recent one of which someone, we don't know who, audiotaped the proceedings and then leaked the statement that Bradley made in the courtroom, where witnesses who were there have told me he was, you know, far and away the most cool-headed, courageous, and articulate and moral individual in the room, who made perfectly clear, just as he had in the cables that have always been the chat logs that have always been part of the case, that his motivation was democratic with a small d, that he was seeking to inform the public of what was being done in its name with its money. He was seeking no financial or other gain for himself. He was taking a risk quite heroically to inform the public of what was being done. And the results have been tremendous. I mean, the credit he is given by nations in the Arab world for stimulating the Arab Spring and assisting it, the role information he's exposed has helped in better results and exposure and prosecution of crimes in Latin America, the nomination he's received for a Nobel Peace Prize from members of parliament in a variety of nations around the world. At rootsaction.org, in fact, we launched a petition to the Norwegian Nobel Committee asking that Bradley Manning, as a nominee, in fact receive this next year's Nobel Peace Prize. It's just shot through the roof, the number of signatures on this petition, and we're going to actually go and deliver it in Norway with all the names. So if you want to sign it, go to rootsaction.org, where we also have a petition we'll be delivering that says, take back Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize, revoke
it. Well, I think they should just give Obama's to Bradley Manning.
Yeah, I mean, technically there are issues with that, you know, in terms of timing and who did what in which year, but yeah, essentially you could do that and give someone else the Nobel Peace Prize this year. But I think quite clearly Bradley Manning is the one who fits the qualifications laid out in Alfred Nobel's will for getting this year's prize.
Now, he is, of course, was hooked up with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Where is Julian Assange right now, and what's the status of his case?
He's locked in the Ecuadorian embassy to the United Kingdom in London. He has been given asylum by the nation of Ecuador, the courageous nation of Ecuador that famously told the Bush administration, you can have a military base here if we can have one in Miami. the nation of Ecuador that has proven quite moral and law-abiding and heroic in this instance, is, you know, providing sanctuary to Julian Assange there in London, but he is not able to leave and fly to Ecuador or anywhere else, and is, you know, running for the Senate in Australia from his prison in the middle of London, and he's communicating, he's doing interviews, he's you know, he's not locked away, and WikiLeaks is in fact working quite productively, but Julian Assange is the primary target here, and the interest in going after Bradley Manning was primarily in trying to get something on Julian Assange, and that has proven entirely unsuccessful thus far in this kangaroo court that we you know, that we call a court martial.
So, God, I hope he's got some exercise equipment in the Ecuadorian embassy there. I hope he's comfortable. So he's been there a long time. How long has Julian Assange been in the Ecuadorian embassy, you know?
I it's got to be coming up on a year, I think.
Yeah, it is a long time. I guess I could Google it. We're running out of time here. But, David,
well, and,
it,
and it's
you,
a few years.
But... left here. David Swanson, Secretary of Peace in the Green Shadow Cabinet with President Jill Swanson, and me, Secretary of Energy. We are just almost out of time, David, and you are always so full of amazing. Steph, what's the number one thing you want to say to an American audience right now, if you had, which you do, about 3 minutes?
They lied about Iraq. They're lying about Syria. It's time to stop being suckers. It's time to stop imagining that they're telling the truth when they tell us we're powerless. We have incredible power. We can make them listen. We can make them not attack Syria. It is, you know, 80% of the U.S. public, to our great credit, have told the pollsters want Syria attacked. We need to tell the media, tell the Congress, tell our neighbors, this is a serious, serious danger. This leads to the next war with Iran, with which will be even worse. You know, we have to think long term. We have to move to a peace economy, but we also have to stop these wars before they start. And they are trying to start one right now, in Syria, that can only be damaging for the people of that poor nation.
Well, they're talking about, I mean, you mentioned the idea of the war with Syria would be a sort of a gateway to overthrow the government of Iran. I mean, what do we want in Iran other than what's there? You know, you've got this front man, been a job, but he doesn't even have much power. What is Iran doing that's so dreadful to the United States?
Well, Ahmadinejad has weeks left in his term. Iran, like the United States, has you know, two 4-year terms, and you're out. I don't think we should be asking what Iranians want for the United States, and I don't think we should be asking what the United States wants for Iran. I think the United States should run its country. We should attempt to use democracy and try it out ourselves and set an example for the world. Examples are much more powerful than words or bombs, and we should leave the people of Iran the heck alone and let them proceed with their democracy, which is indeed troubled and imperfect, and perhaps influence them in a more progressive direction by means other than the threat of military annihilation.
Thomas More invented the word utopia. Well, that's David Swanson, Secretary of Peace for the Green Party cabinet, shadow cabinet. David, you're at warisacrime.com or warisacrime.org and davidswanson.org. What is your latest book?
I suppose my latest book,
go
to warisacrime.org/Iraq and you'll find my latest book about Iraq.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, for being with us. You're always spectacular, a great peace activist calling us from the home of Thomas Jefferson and Dave Matthews, Charlottesville, Virginia. Next week, we'll be back on Nuclear Power, and we'll be with Rory O'Connor talking about all sorts of issues. I'll be in the studio in New York City to see you in Solartopia a week from now. David, again, thank you so much.
Well, we bit the apple, and the garden was lost.